I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, we will continue our series looking at young people and how they are interacting online. Later in the program, we'll look at how social media sites like Facebook and Twitter might help educators create more effective lesson plans. That's later. But first, as President Obama begins his second term in office, we continue our focus on some of the unresolved issues from his first 4 years. Today, we're talking about something the president cares about and talks about often, which is education, and often the focus is on K through 12, but the president has made some key commitments in higher education too.
We will provide the support necessary for all young Americans to complete college and meet a new goal. By 2020, America will once again have the highest proportion of college graduates in the world. That is a goal we can meet.
To meet the president's goal, the country would need to produce 8 million additional college graduates by the year 2020. But some observers are saying that the path to that goal may be more complicated and expensive than the administration has acknowledged. To talk more about this, we've called upon Anthony Carnevale. He is the director and research professor of the Georgetown University Center on Education and the Workforce. And he's with us once again. Professor Carnevale, welcome back to the program. Thanks so much for joining us once again.
Thank you.
Let's talk a little bit more about what the president said. He wants America to lead the world again in the proportion of college graduates. Could you just give us an example of where the country stands now?
We were number one in the world in terms of college graduates until 1992, and we've been slipping ever since. We're 12th or 13th now, there has been a persistent itch to do something about that to two or three administrations.
Who's number one?
Number one in the world is Belgium, although people say, how can you compare us to Belgium? Well, Canada beats us, too.
So the president says that that is a goal we can meet. Is it a modest goal? Is it an ambitious goal? How would you characterize it?
It is an appropriate goal. We know that we're underproducing college graduates in America. We have been since about 1982. The demand for college, as is evident in the wage premium for college, which has risen from 30% in 1983 to 84% by 2002, tells us that the increase in the demand has been about 3% a year, and the increase in supply of college talent has been about 1%. So it's not just a noble goal. It's a very practical economic goal.
Hey, when you say we are underproducing college graduates, you mean what by that?
Employers say all the time that they're not finding the talent they need. And in truth, they're right. The demand began rising in 83 because of powerful technology change that began automating all repetitive tasks and jobs, leaving the non-repetitive tasks is the short story. And in the end, that required higher levels of education. And in America, it means college.
So let's talk about what it will take to get there. One of the things that, you know, people have talked a lot about in recent years is the skyrocketing cost of college tuition, which has far outstripped the rate of inflation. Is that one reason why the U.S. is underproducing college graduates, as you've said? And is that something that policy can do something to address?
In the end, the problem is financial, and truth be told, it's going to be very hard to get there from here. If we do produce enough to take back the number one spot in the world, it would cost us something on the order. You get different estimates. Some people say $100 billion, others say $150, some go a little above that. But $150 billion in the current budgetary climate is a huge ask. So the president and others have moved to a different strategy, which is they're going to try to make college affordable by making college more efficient.
How is that $100 billion figure arrived at? When you're saying realistically it would cost $100 billion, what does that pay for?
In the end, in order to produce an associate's degree or a bachelor's degree in America, costs us about $25,000 a person. Multiply that times 10 and you get 250,000, you get 10 million, you get 250 billion. Mm-hmm. So there are other ways to arrive at it, and that number you can get at it several ways, but that's the simplest way, and it ends up being just about the same as more sophisticated ways.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about President Obama's stated goal to produce 8 million additional college graduates by the year 2020. Our guest is Anthony Carnevale of the Georgetown University Center on Education and the Workforce. You said that reaching this goal is going to cost more than most people understand. So what is the administration doing from a policy perspective to try to reach this goal?
In the end, this administration and the Bush administration before it have recognize that in order to join the middle class, you've got to get some kind of post-secondary education in the American economy nowadays. And Bill Clinton used to say, we ought to give everybody high school plus 2 years, and he intended to fund it. What's happened since is that that has become less and less affordable. So the political position is moved. Everybody says everybody ought to go to college who can handle it, and it ought to be the majority of us. But the strategy ends up being affordability. How do we do this with less money?
What about the whole question of building a workforce that, you know, for want of a better phrase, looks like America? I mean, we recently spoke with John Sylvanus Wilson Jr. He's been tapped as the new president of Morehouse College. It's a very prestigious, all-male, historically black college, you know, in Atlanta. But he was very candid about the challenges that he's facing in trying to, you know, maintain standards and so forth at his institution. It's not just HBCUs, but there are a number of institutions around the country that specifically serve the Native American population and that have large percentages of Latino students who see themselves as minority-serving institutions. Do they have to do something different to meet this goal?
In the end, it comes down to money and whether or not we're going to continue to give funding to institutions for special purposes, that is to serve special populations. Americans are not happy to do that. The real trend here that's very powerful is that the white flight that began in the United States in the 1950s, where white people fled the center city and fled African Americans in truth in part, but what they were fleeing to better schools, better high schools, and in the end, the denouement, the result of all that is very apparent now in higher education, which is that the white flight to the leafy green suburbs is now moved to the leafy green campuses, and our higher education system is very stratified, with Hispanics and blacks concentrated in the two-year and non-easy open admission four-year schools, and white people moving up very aggressively into the upper tiers, and that makes a substantial difference in the outcomes.
Give us some numbers, if you would.
Over the last, since about 1995, if we look at all the movement of white students into higher education, almost 80% of them are moving into the top 430 schools. African Americans have been there at about an 8 or 9% rate. And that's stalled. It's not growing. It hasn't grown since the middle 90s. And in the case of Hispanics, as a result of their growing population share, their share of the higher end of the higher education system, the good four-year schools, is declining. And more, both African Americans and Hispanics are concentrated in the two-year schools where graduation rates are 40%, as opposed to the more successful four-year colleges where they spend a lot more money and their graduation rates are over 80%.
Is there a strategy to address this?
Not that I can tell. I mean, the truth is that if you and I are college presidents and they start cutting our budgets, and then they tell us on top of that that we've got to have higher graduation rates and faster time to graduation, the only thing we can really do is compete with each other for the students who can go full-time and pay full cost, and that's what's happening in the system. It's pushing the people who are working when they go to college and people who come from less affluent families down the line into the less successful institutions.
Along those lines, we've talked a lot about the economics of this goal. What about the academics? And that's related, that 22% of American young people don't graduate from high school on time. That's a fifth. And we've frequently talked, and you've talked with us, about how many high school graduates now come to college unprepared to do the work. And as a consequence of that, they're spending their college time doing remedial work, which means they have to pay for that. And they often have to extend the time that they're in college because they're spending their beginning years in college doing remedial work. Is there a strategy to address that?
In truth, no. The urge over the next decade and perhaps beyond in higher education is for efficiency. And efficiency is about getting more bang for the buck. And in the end, that means that the whole system is trying to move upstream to get the more affluent and well-prepared student. The whole apparatus has an unyielding industrial organization that the competition is about becoming more selective always. That's how you become a better college, is you get better students. So there is a tendency to move away from minorities and move away from low-income kids.
So, you know, you're actually painting a very dire picture here. And I wonder if that's because of the questions I'm asking or because, in fact, you feel that there's a very large gulf between what the administration is hoping to do and the actual steps that it will take to get there? Or is it that that goal might be achieved, but it's really going to be achieved by middle-class white kids? Is that really what you're saying?
In the end, that's what I'm saying. And there is some optimism in this. That is, there are every year we graduate 4 million kids from high school, and every year about 500,000 of them that are in the upper half of their high school graduating class, we know when we look at them 8 years later, they haven't got either a two-year or four-year degree. So there is some low-hanging fruit here, and part of it is minority. Part of it is African-American and Hispanic, but the majority of it is white working class.
Well, to be continued, Anthony Carnevale is the director and research professor of the Georgetown University Center on Education and the Workforce, and he was kind enough to join us here in our Washington, D.C. studios. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Coming up, a lot of Americans are tapping accounts intended for retirement to pay for things they need or think they need now. We'll find out who's doing this and why and if it's worth it. We'll talk about it in our Money Coach conversation, and that's just ahead on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin. I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, we have the latest installment in our series, Social Me. We'll talk about how educators could use their students' social media habits to figure out how they learn. But first, to matters of personal finance, we want to talk about retirement. While earlier generations might have had a pension, now millions of Americans, if they have any savings, probably have some kind of retirement account like a 401k. Well, our next guest says Americans are draining their 401ks and other retirement savings accounts at an alarming rate, and that could have devastating consequences later on when they actually want to retire. Michael Fletcher wrote about this recently. He covers economics for The Washington Post, and he's with us now. Welcome. Thanks so much for joining us.
Good to be here, Michelle.
So put this in perspective for us. How many people are we talking about here, and how much money are we talking about here?
Well, the report from the financial advisory firm Hello Wallet said roughly one in four Americans are tapping their retirement accounts for non-retirement needs. And that amounts to a bunch of money. That amounts to roughly a quarter of the nearly $300 billion a year people put into their retirement accounts. So in essence, you have people putting money into these accounts, which have kind of high-risk investments, relatively high-risk, high-cost investments in terms of money management fees, and they're using them essentially as a rainy day or emergency fund.
You know, you wrote in your piece, according to this report from Hello Wallet, that those in their 40s, people in their 40s, are more likely to do this, that actually a third of these folks are turning to these accounts. Why them? Why are these people the more likely to do this than anybody else?
People speculate about this. There hasn't been a full survey on that, but the idea is that really life happens to people in their 40s. People have homes. They may fall behind on a mortgage. They may have kids who are going to college. They may have two cars, and one of the transmissions has gone up, and they don't have money elsewhere, so they turn to their 401k to sort of help them out of a sort of temporary financial crisis.
Why is this worrisome? Why are people so worried about this? And I note that this financial advisory firm aren't the only people to talk about this. The Senate committee issued a report in July that talked about this as part of a retirement crisis. Why is this so worrisome?
It's very worrisome because the other supports for retirement are slowly going away. You know, Social Security remains the mainstay, and lawmakers are even eyeing Social Security for trims going forward. But just 30 years ago, 4 out of 5 workers in the private sector had traditional pensions on their job. Not many people collected a bunch of money from them, but they still provided some measure of security. So you knew you're going to get X number of dollars per month for the rest of your life once you retired, and you didn't have to worry about managing that as a worker. Your employer took care of that, and you had that. You supplemented that with your Social Security payment, and you can make it through retirement. In many ways, that's lifted the current retirees to sort of a higher standard of living than previous retirees have ever enjoyed. But now that traditional pensions are going away, now 1 in 5 people have those. We're left to use our 401ks as sort of the major mechanism for financing our retirements beyond Social Security. So if you drain the money now, you're not going to have it later. And the power of the 401k really is in compound interest. So you have to keep, even if it seems like a little bit of money, you have to keep it in there. And if you keep it in there over a career, 30 or 40 years, when you get to the end, you should have a substantial amount of money. But many people don't see their way to doing that.
Could you talk a little bit about some of the people that you interviewed in the course of, you know, pursuing this story? Why is it that people feel that this is where they have to turn for money?
The trouble is that Americans are pressed financially from all sides. If you think about the traditional ladders of kind of upward mobility in this society, you know, higher education, you were just, you know, talking about that. That's gotten more expensive. Health care has gotten more expensive. And wages have been flat for many, many people. The working class in this country has barely seen a raise over the last 10 or 15 years. So people are pressed financially. I talked to one woman who's worked as a hotel housekeeper since the mid-1980s. She works in Baltimore, 62 years old, had hip surgery, a hip replacement operation this summer, and is struggling with that and is thinking about having to retire now because she doesn't see herself being able to work. And she had a 401k the entire time and now has only $60,000. It sounds like a good amount of money, and most people to say you have $60,000 somewhere, that sounds like something. But this will have to supplement her retirement for the rest of her life. She'll be able to collect Social Security right away, but she doesn't get Medicare until she's 65 years old, and that's not a lot of money. But you talk to her about why. She says, well, I had home repairs. I had other financial things come up, and I really had no other source of money. And this woman made $13 an hour, so where was she supposed to save money? So that's the difficulty. I think people are financially pressed.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Michael Fletcher of The Washington Post. He wrote about the growing number of people who are dipping into their retirement funds. It's actually a very large number of people. As many as 1 in 3 people in their 40s are doing that, and they're using this to pay for things that are not retiring. And we're talking about the possible consequences of that. Michael, I wanted to ask, though, the tone of a lot of the financial managers who write about this is kind of, how can I put it, judgmental. Judgmental, which is what's wrong with these people. And I just have to ask, isn't part of it that, you know, trust is broken with the people who many people have relied upon to give them financial advice in over decades? I mean, is it that, people were told that, the banks don't want to foreclose, that they'll work with you, and then they find that they can't actually get anybody on the phone, that if they need to negotiate, you know, a job loss or a certain situation, or they find that their, you know, retirement accounts or their savings accounts are not earning any money. And as you said, that, you know, people's wages have been flat for quite a long period of time. I mean, is it a situation where people just don't believe the kinds of people, the authority figures who they've been relying on all these years to give them advice, and they figure they might just go on their own and make the best decisions that they can make just right in front of them?
Yeah, that could be part of it. But I think probably the larger issue is that people aren't getting any financial advice. I mean, it's sort of out there in the ether that you should save, you know, your 401k money. But people look at their balances, and particularly early on, they don't seem very substantial. You might have $1,000 or $2,000, and a financial emergency arises. And it may not even be a full emergency. Sometimes people change jobs and decide, you know, I'll wipe out a few bills and move on, maybe buy a couple of treats for myself, you know, a couple of luxury items, a TV or something like that. So I think it's a combination of people not really realizing the long-term implications of tapping this money, particularly earlier in their careers.
But let me ask you, though, about this. Why doesn't it make sense for someone to take out a loan against their own retirement account at a favorable rate, like a 3 or 4% interest rate, instead of taking a loan out from a credit card company or some other, you know, vendor at 15% or 12%? Why doesn't that make sense?
I mean, that makes sense when you frame it that way. But I think what people have to think about is sort of having different pots of money first. And it's easier said than done. Again, we just pointed out that people don't have the money. I think that's the underlying problem here. But, you know, the idea is that you should have an emergency savings account to deal with these sort of life things that are going to happen, the broken, you know, heating system in your home, the transmission that goes up in cost. We know, you know, thousands of dollars.
And so people are using it. It sounds like you're familiar with this. I'm just going to say there's a level of detail here that sounds like you're familiar with this. But that what you're saying is people don't have that emergency fund and they're using their 401ks as their emergency fund.
And it's costing them a lot of money. And that's the thing.
How much money?
I mean, because when you withdraw, now the loans are one thing, and the loans are probably the least damaging way of tapping your 401ks. But many people are doing withdrawals, which puts you in line for a 10% federal penalty, plus you have to pay the deferred taxes on that income. So the income when you earned it that was put into the 401k was not taxed, but once you withdraw it, you have to add that to your income tax bill for the coming year. So that becomes
That's expensive money.
But not only that, if it's in the stock market, you know, we know how volatile the stock market's been. If you happen to need that money at a down period, you're losing that investment income too. You know, you could be at a down point in the market and need the money, so you're losing that. So you probably would have been better off having it in a money market or in a savings account.
Okay, Mike, we only have a minute left, so I need to ask you this: is there something, as we noted, this has gotten the attention of at least some lawmakers and policymakers? Is there something from a policy standpoint that's being contemplated here?
Well, the thing is, Senator Harkin is one of the people talking about the need for another tier of retirement savings in this country to supplement Social Security. It seems unlikely that that will happen, but he's talking about the need for that. Beyond that, some people have talked about the idea of making it more difficult for people to tap their 401ks, but the complication there is that surveys have shown that if people no, they can't tap that money, they're less likely to participate in 401ks to begin with.
Interesting.
And there's a problem there as well.
Michael Fletcher is a reporter for The Washington Post. He was kind enough to join us from their studios in Washington, D.C. Thanks so much for joining us, Michael.
My pleasure.
Now let's take a look at how young people are interacting online. It's the latest in our series of conversations around social media and young people. It's a short series we're calling Social Me. Yesterday, we talked about the ways young people are exploring different online identities. We talked about the fact that there could be a positive side to that, as well as the negative side that we hear so much about. Today, we want to look at how websites kids visit and the apps that they download could be used to enhance their educations. To tell us more about that, we're joined once again by Ray Hung. He is a faculty associate at Harvard's Berkman Center for Internet and Society. Ray Junco, welcome back. Thanks for joining us once again.
Thanks for having me back, Michelle.
Now, there's a technical term for what we're talking about here, learning analytics. In layman's terms, what are learning analytics?
Well, learning analytics is the use of student-produced data to predict outcomes and tailor education. So it's often thought of as a practical application of big data in education. So in other words, it's collecting large amounts of data to identify patterns that will help tailor education more precisely for each child. So if you think about how a website like Amazon.com knows the kinds of things you like based on your shopping habits, imagine the same thing for education. So I think of learning analytics as the ultimate formative assessment. We're always talking in education about how formative assessments are very important. It's important to assess frequently and to make adjustments. We've got data well before a student will flunk a first exam or a quiz, and so we can make some predictions about the things that they're doing and how we might intervene before we get to that point. And so, for instance, in college, you might be taking a class where there are only three exams and then a final. And so it's very important to identify what some of these risk factors are, and we can do that with learning analytics.
Are educators doing this now?
Not much. There are some applications that are collecting data Generally, what you see is learning analytics applied to course management systems. And course management systems is basically just a fancy way of saying an online discussion board. And they are looking at how many times a student will respond to a discussion, how quickly they respond to a discussion, how often they log on. So just very, very basic levels of data that they're looking at. And so the predictive models are not as accurate as they could be.
What is your research in this area about?
I think we could be doing so much more with learning analytics. So for instance, students are providing a lot of what I call trace data. So data on their use of technologies, data that they leave behind just by the nature of what they do every day. So their Facebook use and their Twitter use and their Instagram use and their mobile phone use. So some of my research has already shown that we can use things like how much time students spend on Facebook and what they do on Facebook to predict academic outcomes. So I'm actually engaged in a project right now where I'm collecting trace data on college students to create more precise predictive models. And then with more data comes the ability to be more precise and to tailor better interventions to help support students.
Is there anything that just, forgive me for using this term, regular people could do to use this kind of data now? For example, I mean, you know, you often see these days with people who, you know, are privileged enough to be able to have like a tablet computer or you know, even a smartphone. I mean, you see people waiting in line, you see people at the grocery store, the kid gets antsy, what do people do? They pull out their phone or they pull out a tablet, they hand it to the child who can play and entertain himself or herself for quite some time. There are all kinds of apps out there that kids are already attracted to. Some of them they're finding on their own or they're finding out about from their friends. Is there anything you think that people could do on their own to use this time more productively?
Sure. Well,
without being corny about it. I mean, obviously, you know, the kiss of death is the educational app, educational software. You know perfectly well your kid's going to run screaming from that.
Well, certainly that would be great. The learning analytics kind of process takes some resources. So typical apps don't have any kind of learning analytics integration. However, there are consumer-level applications and services that let you monitor what you do online. And we know from other areas, so for instance, there's this, you know, movement about collecting a lot of information about yourself, the quantified self movement, right? And so how many steps you walk every day, using something like the Fitbit or the Nike Fuel Band to check in on how well you're doing towards your fitness goals. And we know from the research that the act of monitoring and tracking your own behavior changes your behavior. So just the act of monitoring changes your behavior. So there are some consumer applications out there that you can sign up for. You can install software on your computer. You can install software on your cell phone. And it gives you a report at the end of the day. And it says, this is how you used your time. And some of these will say, here's how much time you spent in unproductive activities. And here's how much time you spent in productive activities.
Is there any sign that kids like this, too? I mean, I think that people who just heard what you said, you know, the pedometer that some companies are even giving them to their employees now to urge them to, you know, walk more during the day, or those Fit bands or those wristbands that people have bought. A lot of people, I'm sure, got those for holiday presents. Is there any sign that kids like those, too, that kids respond to those, too?
To things like the Nike Fuel Band and Fitbit and things like that.
Yeah.
You know, I haven't seen any research on that.
Well, here's an area for you.
Yes. And actually, I'm thinking about it from a more learning analytics perspective, not from the quantified self and the health data perspective, but just finding out how amenable they are to learning analytics.
See, I've given you a new idea.
Yes, you have. Okay. Thanks, Michelle.
Right. Ray Junko is a faculty associate at the Harvard Berkman Center for Internet and Society. He joined us from WPSU at Penn State University. Ray Junko, thanks for joining us.
Sure. Thank you for having me.
Tomorrow, we'll be talking about an issue that many parents are concerned about, and teachers, how children are protected or are not protected by digital privacy laws. So please join us for that conversation. Just ahead, we are going to keep our focus on kids and technology, but this time from a parent's point of view. When your child is a social media maven and you still don't know your Facebook from your Twitter feed, what do you do? Do you try to catch up or try to slow the kids down? And most important, how do you keep them safe? Our Parenting Roundtable takes a crack at those questions. That's coming up on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin. I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. They say it takes a village to raise a child, but maybe you just need a few moms in your corner. Every week, we check in with a diverse group of parents for their common sense and savvy advice. We want to continue the conversation about children and technology that we've been having on the program this week. It's our mini-series we call Social Me. Now we want to talk about how parents can find their way in this new world. Now, parents finding it hard to communicate with their children is as old as time itself, but this may be the first generation of parents who have to overcome a digital divide with their kids. And at a time when more kids text their friends than call them, many parents are still struggling to master the technology that their kids use every day. So today we're asking, how do you let your kids explore and learn from digital media while protecting them from some real-world concerns? Joining us to talk about this are Lynn Schofield-Clark. She's the author of the new book, The Parent App, Understanding Families in the Digital Age. She's also a mom of two. Angelica Perez-Litwin is a blogger, clinical psychologist, and mom of four. Christopher John Farley is the senior editor of the Wall Street Journal Speakeasy blog, and he's the dad of two. Welcome to you all, and welcome back to some of you. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
Thanks, Michelle.
Professor Clark, your book is fascinating because it's one of those books that parents will pick up and go, thank you, I was just thinking about this myself. I didn't know what to do. And you say, you know, I have no interest in contributing to the already healthy amount of anxiety that parents have about technologies. Well, thank you for that. But are there some common dilemmas that people constantly present you with?
Yes. Actually, there are, first of all, common worries among parents, and I'm sure that we could all recite them. There are concerns about how young people might encounter people who may want to cause them danger, predators online. There are concerns about cyberbullies, concerns about young people running into inappropriate content like porn, and then more practical concerns like how do you help your teen to understand that it's important to not text while driving. I think that there are one of the key things that has happened is that because, as you said, Michelle, parents are less familiar with the technology than their children are in many cases, we've seen this kind of merging of trends between this fear about technology or concern about what technology might mean in the lives of young people and this intersecting with the trend toward helicopter parenting. And so I think that's a real concern that's happening because I think basically what parents feel is this need to strike a balance between allowing young people to have increasing independence as they get older and a desire to help guide our young people through those key moments as they're growing up.
Well, I'm going to ask you to hold that thought for a minute because one of the things that I learned from your book, which I also found fascinating, is that parents have very different strategies for addressing this, which may be one reason why they're so anxious because there is not a common set of norms about this. So hold that thought. I'm going to turn to some of our other guests. Angelica Perez-Litwin, you have said that technology has actually been really great for your relationship, particularly with your oldest, who's in college. Talk a little bit about that.
Oh, absolutely. As a parent, communication is key for me between myself and my children. And I remember when my oldest daughter started high school, she would send me text messages, although, of course, they're not supposed to use the phone in school. And she would say, Mom, what do you think about this? This just happened. And it was just such a wonderful way to be connected to her. I knew she needed me at that moment to just either send her a quick, you know, note or a thought, and we would continue that conversation when she would come home. So I always say texting has been amazing for our relationship, and we continue to do that now that she's in college.
Presumably, though, not while she's driving.
No, she's driving.
Okay. Well, Christopher John Farley, one of the things that you talked to us about was the fact that your 10-year-old recently spent a play date creating a website and his own comic book company. And I'm sure you were very proud, but I'm sure that also opened up some interesting questions for you, too. So why don't you talk about that?
Yeah, it is interesting to see the power of technology sort of on display like that. You know, my son is 10 years old now. This happened when he was 9. Invited a friend over for a play date, and they were there for a couple hours working on the computer. And by the time they were done, they had set up their own computer company. They had found a site that allows you to set up your own web page, and all they needed was my credit card. And by the end of that play date, they had pictures up. They had a story of their company, and even put a sign up outside my office renaming it the Carnage Comics headquarters. So I've been kicked out of my own office.
Did you give them the credit card and let them go on the website and do all that, set it all up?
I did, because it's something that I do monitor. I do check to see what pictures they're putting up, how it's going. I don't think Vecchi sold anything yet. I don't know if they're allowed to sell anything, but they certainly have put up some interesting pictures and they're having fun with it. And I think it's good to see kids having that kind of entrepreneurial spirit and using technology to sort of launch something that's interesting and different, and they connect to their interests. And I was actually shocked to see they were able to put it together so quickly and so effectively.
Is there anything you're worried about, Christopher?
I am worried in that because they have their own website, they were then able to generate their own email address because the website has an email address associated with it. And my son quickly used that to set up his own Instagram account, something he knows he's not allowed to do. Because I didn't want the kids on Instagram, partly because of their terms of service, I still need to assess what that means in terms of your ownership over the photos you put up there and the images you put up there. They seem to have sort of a moving target on what that's about. And I wanted to make sure that he was in control of whatever he put out there. And so he used the email address to set up an Instagram account. And it turns out a lot of kids in his class and at his school have their own Instagram accounts, and they're communicating all the time and showing each other photos, and this whole sort of world going on out there that I'm not certain a lot of parents are closely monitoring.
Lynn Schofield-Clark, what about that?
Yeah, I think that's really interesting. And Christopher, when you were talking about your 10-year-old creating a website and comic book, it reminded me of one of my own stories that I'm a mother of a 14-year-old son and a 12-year-old daughter. And my 14-year-old is also very interested in entrepreneurial opportunities. He's trying to raise some money so that he can buy a backpack for himself. We live in Colorado, and so he really loves the outdoors. And so he'd been looking around for websites to try to find a way to make money. And he considers himself a pretty good writer. So he found this website called Fiverr, which enables you to kind of sell your wares for $5. And if you can do something, you advertise it on the site, and then other people will hire you to do whatever it is that you say you're going to do for $5. So he said that he would write reviews about games. And he wrote a review and submitted it, and the person then wrote back to him and said, well, this isn't quite up to speed, so I'm not going to give you the $5. And so he came and reported it to me. He said, well, you know, I don't know why they didn't want to give me the $5, but now I have to write another review. And so that kind of got me curious, like, what is this site? And I realized that I was finding myself in this position that I found in a lot of parents that I had interviewed for my book, The Parent App, which was that my first instinct was to have this feeling of shock and sort of shame, like, oh my God, how can I be a parent and not know about this site that's online? But of course, I mean, parents can never know everything that's available online. And I think that's one of the things that we all have to figure out how to deal with is that sense of fear that we have. And I think one of the things that I've found, both in my research with parents that are effectively dealing with these kinds of issues, and then also something that I'd apply to my own family setting, is that I think it's important for us to see ourselves as parents, as learners along with our young people. And so I think that what we did in our family then was we kind of had a conversation and said, well, show us what Fiverr is. Let's look at this website. Let's look at what, you know, who's selling what. I should say that before I even got to that point, I had said to John, my son, well, I'll help you to rewrite this review so that you can get your $5. So I spent an hour, you know, helping him edit the review. And so part of our conversation was to then say, okay, so now, you know, between the two of us, we've invested enough time so that we're getting about $1 an hour for our work.
I don't know. You should go out there and mow the lawn. I mean, you could...
Yeah, exactly. Hey, yeah, so it became kind
borders.
Of... right, yeah. So it became kind of a good lesson, I think, in helping him to think about how to make decisions about where it's appropriate to spend your time. And then we also were able to look at what else people were doing online and to just kind of help him to think about, okay, is this a reasonable way to spend your time? Are there other ways that you might, you know, do things? And so he's now investigated some other opportunities. And yes, mowing the lawn has come up higher on the list as an option, since this seems to be not such a great way to earn money. But I think that what's important...
Let me jump in here, Lynn. In our parenting roundtable, we're taking on digital dilemmas, and we are joined by the author of The Parent App. That's Lynn Schofield Clark. That's who was speaking just now. Wall Street Journal editor Christopher John Farley and psychologist Angelica Perez. Let me just turn to Angelica again. You, as a psychologist, you see children and teens as well. Do digital dilemmas come up there as well with parents in some of the work that you're doing? Obviously, protecting people's privacy, which is important. But does this come up?
Absolutely. And it's pretty much what we've been discussing already here. Many parents come to me and say, I don't know how to monitor her. I don't want to step on her toes. I don't want to invade her privacy. And it always amazes me. I always ask, well, who pays the internet fees? So, it's your computer. I find that parents have a really hard time letting their children know that they are in control, that they are the parents when it comes to social media and engaging online. And I am as a parent, I can easily tell my children, you continue to text that way, you continue to engage online this way, you will not have a phone. And I can easily take that phone away. So for some reason, parents have sort of given up their rights and their control as parents because they feel that that's her computer. No, it's not her computer. It's your computer. And I try to empower parents to understand that it is their right and it is their responsibility to not necessarily be helicopter parents, but really be in control of the situation, understand what their kids are doing, why they're doing it, and how they're spending their time online, and that they also have a right to take it away or to reduce the amount of time that their children are online. So I always see the power issue for the parents coming up.
This is interesting because this actually speaks to something that Professor Clark talked about in a section of the book, along with dilemmas. You noted in your research that there are wide variations, wide cultural differences in how parents address and handle the technology with their kids. And you're saying that in some families, the families really encourage it to enhance education and kind of a sense of personal empowerment with the kids. Mm-hmm. But other families really believe more strongly in that they should use it to be family connected, more family focused. Did you want to talk a little bit about that, Professor Clark? Obviously, you wrote a whole book about it, so you can't tell us the whole story. But give us a little bit.
Right. How long do you want me to talk? No, I really wanted to echo what Angelica was saying, that I think there are parents that are very reluctant to be able to take charge and to be able to, because they're so interested in trying to provide their young people with an opportunity to have a childhood that what I call in my book is full of expressive empowerment. In other words, they encourage their children to use these media for purposes of education and self-development. And so because they're doing that, there are a lot of benefits to that. Obviously, I mean, as your first guest was talking about with Ray Junco, I'm sure that he'll be talking later in the week about how much educators are now trying to connect with parents. And so I think that can be a really positive thing. But on the other hand, it also encourages families to do certain things that I found in my research that could undermine parental goals, like family solidarity, for instance, or would encourage parents to do things more surreptitiously, like involving themselves in using technology to monitor their kids, which kids interpreted as spying. And so that could become a problem, where it would have been much easier if they had just kind of set some very specific expectations for their young people, and the young people would be clear about that. On the other hand, there are some families that do set very clear expectations and tend to have a different approach to parenting, and I call that in my book an approach of respectful connectedness. And in those families, they really want their children to use these media in ways that honor their parents and reinforce family and cultural ties. And I think that can sound really nice, but there are also are extremes to that, too, so that in some cases, parents in those families were they wanted to comfort their children in a frightening world, but it also could result in authoritarian policies, censorship, for instance, that could stifle exploration, or even in some extreme cases, ways that parents used the technologies to shame their children because they weren't behaving in a way that the parents deemed appropriate.
Well, I think, like, we saw an example of that. Remember, there was a story that got a lot of attention where the dad shot up his daughter's laptop because she was inappropriate. I think we all would agree on that. And what some people consider censorship, Angelica, I know you'll agree with me, some of us just consider parenting. But that's a cultural difference, as we've discussed. Christopher John Farley, I think one of the things we haven't talked about, I think the elephant in the room is video games, isn't it?
Yeah, because a lot of video games, of course, have a multiplayer component where kids can play with other kids and maybe adults online. It becomes more and more difficult to see who they're interacting with. And it's something that parents really need to sort of monitor carefully just to know what their kids are doing online. And that's why I think it's important, you know, in terms of control issues, obviously, you know, the parents are in control, but I think that exerting yourself in a way that's really aggressive over the kids and sort of shutting them down when they're just trying to explore what's happening online can really stifle their creativity in a way that I think can be negative for those kids. Mm-hmm. So parents really have to sort of watch that. I mean, and I find when kids are given a certain amount of freedom to explore and see what's out there, and they can do surprising things like starting their own websites and starting their own companies. But just it's on parents to, you know, sit down with them and play the games with them sometimes, sort of know what's on the game and to listen to what they have to say about the game, and also network with other parents to see what they think of the game and find out what their take is on it and how their kids are also interacting with that game as well. All those things can really sort of help to inform the parents and help them make the right decisions with their kids about social media and video games.
You know, it occurs to me that in a way we're almost like we're all immigrants here in a way because, it, you know, the traditional story where the kids translate for the parents, in a way, in this generation, we're sort of digital immigrants where the kids are kind of translating the digital world, you know, for the parents who are visiting this world, but the kids live there, right?
So Michelle,
we have one more. We have time for one more thought. So I think I'm going to give the last word to Professor Clark. So.
Oh, well, thank you. I'm going to try to just kind of wrap up some of the things that both Angelica and Christopher had said, because I think they have so much wisdom in what they're talking about. I think that as a whole, we probably are all trying to communicate similar things in the importance about making parenting something that is both warm and has high expectations for our young people, and thinking about technology policies in relation to those goals that we have as parenting. And secondly, really what I want to bring out is the importance of modeling the behavior that we want. And I think that's something that Christopher had talked about in relation to trying to encourage our parents to play games with young people and to be involved with them. You know, and in my interviews with young people, I heard young people talk about the frustrations they had, for instance, with fathers who checked their mobile phones while they were texting, or about mothers who uploaded photos of their children to Facebook pages without asking permission. And so those kinds of things we'd want to watch as parents, that we model the behavior that we want to see with our children.
Okay.
And then finally,
we have to leave it there.
Let children take the lead.
Leave it there for now. I have to take the lead here because we're out of time. And I hope we'll hear more from all of you in the future. Obviously, this is a conversation that's going to continue. Lynn Schofield Clark is author of the new book, The Parent App, Understanding Families in the Digital Age. She's associate professor of media and journalism at the University of Denver and a mom of two. She was with us from Colorado Public Radio. Also with us, Angelica Perez-Litwin, a clinical psychologist and mom of four and a blogger. She was with us from member station WFUV in the Bronx. And Christopher John Farley is a senior editor of the Wall Street Journal Speakeasy blog, a dad of two, and he was with us from our NPR bureau in New York. Thank you all so much. To be continued.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
And that's our program for today. I'm Michelle Martin, and you've been listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's talk more tomorrow.